The Star Wars universe is constantly expanding.
So how the heck are you going to keep tabs on it without a holocron? And where in the rim can I score the juiciest news and rumors?
Ah, you seek State of the Empire, Nerdy Show's Star Wars speculation podcast that looks for news in Alderaan places.
We dig into the Sarlacc pit of the internet for the hottest intel in the galaxy far, far away, make Indiana Jones inquiries, and keep watch for the latest on Willow.
Head to nerdyshow.com/Star Wars. It's the show you're looking for.
Flame On is presented by the Nerdy Show Network, geeky programming for all nerds across the multiverse. All Nerdy Show programming is made possible by A Comic Shop, Orlando's number one comic shop and nerd destination. And of course, with the generous support of listeners like you. To learn how you can support this and other fine geeky programming, visit nerdyshow.com.
Welcome to Flame On. I am Brian, and this is a very special episode of Flame On.
Aww.
Our plans, the plans that we had, much like life, they don't go the way you think. So, Eric and I are here.
It's just merely delayed.
That's true, but it's whatever. Either way, we're here, and that's what's important. And we're here to start the new year right with movie reviews.
Yay! Why not? Well, I mean, the holidays are always a big time for movie releases.
That's true. So. I actually have seen more movies lately than I had in months just because of the holiday schedule. And
yeah, people have extra time off, yep. So they're like, let's go to the movies.
And there have been some very maybe under-the-radar movies that have come out, at least a couple, sort of-ish. So we're going to talk about that. If you've never heard Flame On before, if this is your first episode, we are a gay, geeky pop culture podcast. We talk mostly about movies, TV, books, music, video games, some comics every now and again, and anything else that comes up that we're excited about. So that's what you're in for. We do spoil. We are not like our colleagues over at Pop Culture Happy Hour and try to, you know, be spoiler-free because there are just times where you need to spoil things. So we'll try not to go too crazy, but just be wary. Maybe even before a big plot point, we might give a little warning, but don't count on it. So if you really want to see the movies we're going to talk about, then I would say go watch it and come back. But if not, you're in for a fun ride. So I will start with a movie that I saw recently that many of our listeners probably are familiar with at least the source material for. That is The Disaster Artist. By the Franco brothers, basically, and about the movie or the making of the movie and surrounding events of the movie called The Room. And yeah. That's the one you're probably familiar with.
You're tearing me apart, Lisa.
Wow. Oh, yeah, all that stuff. Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, so, hi, Mark.
We're not going to do our own Tommy Wiseau impressions here, but that's pretty good. I'm a very recent fan, if you want to call it that, of The Room. I only saw it like a month-ish ago. And a friend of mine at work had been badgering me. And so finally, some other friends sort of suggested about it. And I was like, all right, fine, I'll watch it. And if you haven't seen The Room, I feel like The Disaster Artist is going to not be nearly as exciting. But just to sum up what The Room is, if you're uninitiated and haven't seen this, it was sort of a vanity project made in the early 2000s in California, and this guy, Tommy Wiseau, is the writer, director, producer, funding source, sex double stand-in. I mean, yeah, he did a lot. And he did it with his friend, Greg. And Greg's perspective
old
is...
Old Greg?
Not old Greg, oh. Sorry. That would be amazing, though. If someone could do that, an old Greg Room mashup, I would watch the hell out of that. So this is Greg Sestero. I always think of his name because it sounds like Point Estero, which is a place in Fort Lauderdale, or Fort Myers, sorry. So Greg Sestero wrote a book about his experience with Tommy making The Room and sort of his life. And the movie definitely takes that source material and sort of spins it and expands on it in a way, probably a little fictional, that makes this whole movie a buddy kind of bromance. Tragic-ish, but bromance nonetheless, between Tommy and Greg. And both are – Tommy and Greg meet in an acting class, and they're both in I believe they're not in L.A. when they meet. They're in San Francisco, but they're in acting class, and they hit it off, and they are very fascinated with each other, and they kind of, you know, talk about film and love of, you know, different actors and acting styles and all this stuff. And Tommy is a very sort of iconoclastic, kind of very out there actor, and that really stands out to Greg. And
well, he's an alien, so.
He's an alien.
Yeah.
Is that what you think?
Well, nobody really knows for sure.
So Tommy Wiseau is definitely a caricature of a person. And what I love about Disaster Artist is they definitely play that up. And they also don't try to answer any of these outstanding questions. And Tommy has an interesting accent that sounds like he's probably from somewhere in Central Europe, maybe Eastern Europe. Has an interesting sort of complexion, definitely looks like he's older than you might he might say.
And he's seen things.
Been around. But he also has a lot of money, evidently, somehow. And will not talk about any of these things. And it's kind of funny because the movie, basically point blank in one scene, goes through those three questions. Like, where are you from? Where's your money? Where do you get your money? And what's the third one? I don't know. What did I say? And either way, they don't answer those questions. So that's good. The movie doesn't try to, you know, it keeps some air of mystery about Tommy Wiseau. But The Room is ridiculously awful. And if you've ever seen it or you've seen clips from it, you kind of know what you're in for. It's kind of like if a porno, a softcore porn had really bad production values, limited set and actor choices, and was directed by like a, you know, 10th grader. I mean, really just from start to finish, awful. But so awful that it actually sort of transcends that and has become a cult phenomenon that, you know, they do midnight showings for. And
do you know if they do any of those around here? Our area?
I don't know. I have to look. I would not be shocked, especially around now with the Disaster Artist coming out, that they do, but I haven't seen it. So the Disaster Artist, again, is a movie about this. James Franco plays Tommy Wiseau. A person he clearly reveres in a certain respect, but is also not – he doesn't shy away from some of the more difficult things. I mean, the story is that Tommy was very dictatorial and kind of just an asshole, a terrible person in making this film, very demanding of his actors, unreasonable. He funded the whole thing, doing so extravagantly that he actually filmed digital – high def and regular definition at the same time, which they had never – they just don't do. Like you do one, like the high def and down sampler. You do something so it's not – but he did it at the same time, like with almost the same rig, just two cameras kind of mounted next to each other. And it was just ridiculous and unheard of, and was very like, you know, precious and having his own toilet on set, you know, and – you know, working under extreme conditions and being very demanding of his actress, but from his own acting perspective, when he came time to do his first scene, fell apart and just couldn't handle it and had to take, you know, probably hours to get a good shot in.
Was that the rooftop scene?
It is the rooftop scene, yes. The notorious, oh, hi, Mark scene. It touched.
I did not hit her. I did not.
Yes. Like, this also spawned a YouTube journey of my own, going off and watching remakes of The Room from quote-unquote better filmmakers, and there's been several. But what this movie also, The Disaster Artist, does do, it does not do a complete end-to-end remake, but it does do several key scenes, and if you stay through the credits, you get to watch some of those side-by-side, and it's kind of impressive in many places how well they match up.
Hopefully that'll be a bonus feature on the home release.
I mean, it's in the credits, so I think it'll just stay in the credits.
Well, no, I mean a full remake.
No, they asked that question in a press junket, and Frank was like, no, we didn't film the entire movie. It would have been cool, and I think that it, sure that came up, but, you know, I mean, this is sort of a vanity project for Franco as well. I mean, this is something he's obviously very passionate about. His brother is also passionate about. His brother also, who plays Greg in the movie.
Yeah.
The movie has tons of cameos. Different comedians from all over the place you'll see pop up, and you're like, oh my God. Probably most notable would be Seth Rogen, who plays the like script supervisor and is then also sort of the stand-in director when Wizzo is acting.
Mm-hmm.
And he gets to voice sort of the everyman reaction to the room. Like, it's always his perspective at you. He voices the, why is he fucking her belly button? Or, you know, other key sort of realizations about the film. Overall, again, very well balanced between a loving sort of homage, or, you know, respecting the idea of this and that this guy did this all on his own and all this crap, but also sort of showing the warts, you know, everything.
So they aren't completely just poking fun at the whole process.
In fact, the ending is maybe the most like, okay, so he's the spoiler slightly. I don't know if this is all real events. He shows the film finally in a theater, like a premiere. Does the whole thing. Does it up. It reminded me of my friend Justin's premiere that I went to for one of his short films up in Jersey. Justin's, Eric knows Justin, but I won't call him out by name here. And it, again, it's one of those things where his, you know, he had the premiere, he had the red carpet, he did it up, you know, it's his movie. I get it. But, you know, Wizzo goes into this thinking he's just made the best thing ever. The audience, mostly comprised of people from the cast, but also, you know, friends, family, whoever, they quickly realize this is just dreadful, and they go through the journey of discovery that is watching the room. And but yet by the end, kind of come full circle and like just love how bad it is, and are so enjoy the experience so much that they applaud Tommy at the end of the movie. And so you kind of quickly see Tommy go from utter deject, like terror and sadness, seeing how his movie is so bad, to, oh, wow, I've just unwittingly made this brilliant comedy, and kind of brings that whole full circle by the end of the film. In fact, by the end of the showing, he's up on stage thanking everybody and just like loving life because they're you know, chanting his name. A bit unrealistic, to be sure, but it did put a nice bow on the movie and sort of wraps up that Greg-Tommy relationship beat in a positive, sort of upbeat way. I guess they still... the actor Greg Sestero and Tommy are still good friends and work on projects together. So clearly the experience did not ruin him completely, but there are many times where you think it will. You got to stay at the end of the credits. So not only do they do the side-by-side, but the very end of the credits, I don't want to say what it is, but a certain person makes an appearance in the movie, which makes complete sense, and it's pretty awesome. So yeah, I liked it. I would, if I had to give it a flame rating, which I know is our thing, I would say I wouldn't give it a 5, certainly not a 5. Maybe not even a 4. 3 seems a little too low, maybe 3.5. Because it's good.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely would put the little star next to that rating and say, if you haven't seen The Room, your mileage may vary. Because it could have been a better film. But it's in terms of its context of being a companion piece to The Room, it's a lot like Ed Wood. If Ed Wood didn't have all the cool stylistic touches that Ed Wood had. And certainly Franco didn't try to make a movie about The Room in the style of The Room, if that makes sense.
Because mm-hmm.
that's kind of how Ed Wood is. Ed Wood, oh my God, my brain's not working.
Tim Burton.
Thank you. He set out to make a movie about Ed Wood in a style, in the sort of style of that period and a style of Ed Wood. Like, this movie does some good like 90s, early 2000s music references, but other than that, it's still just a regular, like, you know, decently made Hollywood movie. So from that perspective, I would say as a straight up just storytelling about The Room with a slight nice little bow at the end, 3.5 flames for my preference.
So it certainly deserves some of the nominations it's getting for awards.
I don't know about that. So if it got nominated, great.
Yeah, I mean, for the Golden Globes, I think it's – I would assume that it's in the musical comedy
But I don't even think it's a particularly funny film, really.
Well,
it's a.
Neither was The Martian, and that was a comedy.
What? Oh, that's right. It's so crazy. Long story short, if you're a fan of The Room, go see it. If you're not, maybe go watch The Room first and then come back. But if you do happen to catch it, it might maybe even make you want to watch The Room. Who knows?
Hmm.
All right, so Eric, you saw a movie.
I did see a movie.
And what movie did you see?
The Greatest Showman. The new Hugh Jackman, P.T. Barnum musical.
And how was that?
It was visually appealing. It was... The music was amazing. The choreography was amazing. Visuals were great. The story left a little something to be desired, but I think I went in from all the advertisements thinking, this is the new Moulin Rouge. And this was like a PG-rated Moulin Rouge, in that it just didn't take any risks or felt like edgy at all. It was just very sweet and soft, because you have Zac Efron falling in love with Zendaya in the early 1900s, which obviously he comes from a very well-to-do family, and she is a street urchin
and
of
mixed,
color.
Yeah, of color, yeah, yeah.
So that kind of, it's, I mean, it's obviously shown that it was not approved of by his family, but
right,
it doesn't do a deep dive into that.
So this was
conflict.
Not Baz Luhrmann.
No, this was not Baz Luhrmann.
Which, when I first saw the trailer, I thought, oh my god, this looks like a total Baz Luhrmann movie.
Oh, it certainly did.
Which I think is the point. They were going for that Moulin Rouge, and then, of course, it's a composer. The music was the same one who did La La Land.
Yes, and Dear Evan Hansen, and...
Oh, I didn't realize that was his, too.
Well, it's a pair. It's, okay. Yeah. It's a pair of guys, and they also did something else recently on Broadway in the last couple of years. But yeah, they're the current It musical duo. And yeah, the music's really great. I know the one big song, This Is Me, Kesha's already done a cover of it. So I think that's going to have a lot of traction going forward. It would make sense that they would do a whole pop album of it. Even just listening to the soundtrack, I picked out a couple... artists that I think would fit certain different songs.
It's interesting because it looks like he's not... the director is Michael Gracey.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's visual effects.
He was also the director.
Okay.
Yeah.
So not known for a whole lot. Has done other work, but not as a director. Written by anyone famous? Oh, Bill Condon.
Yeah.
Wow.
He kind of co-did it with Hugh Jackman. I know Hugh Jackman's not credited.
No,
but,
I was say, it looks like
Hugh Jackman, this was definitely his passion project that he pushed for this movie to be made for a long time.
And to say what it's about, I mean, you kind of buried the lead a little bit. Yeah. It's
P.T.
Barnum.
Story of P.T. Barnum and the formation of the Barnum. I mean, Bailey isn't involved yet, but the circus and...
So, and it's funny this came up, and it's kind of like one of the odd synchronicities, because there was a Legends of Tomorrow episode probably about a month and change ago that was all about P.T. Barnum and sort of the beginning of the circus and all that stuff, too. And, like, they did not portray him very well. Billy Zane.
Historically, he's not a very pleasant figure.
Yeah, and so this movie, I'm sure, shows him warts and all. No, it does not.
I mean... I guess he has a wart in that, but he finds himself in the end and everything's happy and he reconciles with everyone.
Well,
and
nice Hollywood ending.
Exactly.
So evidently, this is interesting, John Debney and Joe Trapanese, both composers I'm familiar with. Debney's done a ton of stuff. Trapanese, actually, the most recent thing I know he's done is Tron. He did that with the Tron Legacy. Mm-hmm. Some of the stuff that came out of that, he did a lot of music with Daft Punk. But the songwriting group, Pasek and Paul,
yes,
are the ones who've done, I guess, La La Land and other shows, or Dear Evan Hansen.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, so great music. Okay, acting overall.
Yeah, the acting is
just
pretty
good.
With
was
what,
pretty
with, yeah, with what they have to do with Michelle Williams is good. Not great. She plays Hugh Jackman's wife.
Okay.
Yep.
Like, do they, other than the fact they don't portray Barnum necessarily very accurately, do they take any other stylistic variations on, like, that period, or do they try to make it look pretty true to the early 1900s?
I mean, you tell that's where they are, but it doesn't feel really gritty
at
all.
Is it heightened, though, kind of like the way Moulin Rouge kind of made... was it Paris from the, what was Moulin Rouge set early?
The 1920s, I think.
1920s, okay, yeah. So, it was like very over the top, stylized, you know.
Somewhere in between that and Gangs of New York, somewhere in the middle there.
I mean, overall, you enjoyed the film, but it's,
I did.
From what I know, when we first talked about this, I mean, you certainly felt like it was a little of a letdown.
Yeah, in that I didn't really connect emotionally with the main storyline in that P.T. Barnum's life. I mean, you feel a little bit for the folks in the sideshow.
And I was actually curious how they were going to portray some of those folks, because like a bearded lady in that era was just, just a bearded lady. For whatever reason, usually a genetic anomaly, whatever. I didn't know if they were going to take that as an opportunity to sort of explore transsexuality. I mean, I didn't know how they were going to approach that.
Not really. You kind of see they're treated just as freaks.
But I mean, the metaphor was strong, though, I'm sure, as far as like, you know, the freaks, quote unquote, are kind of a metaphor maybe for the outcasts in our society, or the people treated a little less well. And
right, the unwashed, the unclean.
Exactly. You know, so they pull that card, of course.
Yeah. There's definitely lots of protests about the whole show in general.
Right.
And I feel for the opera singer who's brought in when P.T. Barnum tries to do a legitimate act. And so he sponsors this opera singer from Sweden to come over and perform across the U.S. And it's a whole will they, won't they affair type storyline. And it's interesting because she's a real, I mean, her in history, yes, he did this. He brought an opera singer over.
Right.
And unfortunately, her voice is dubbed. It's not the actress's voice. Yeah, but
that happens.
But the song they gave her isn't an opera piece, which is a little interesting. But makes sense in the whole theme of the show.
Well, I mean, they didn't break out into modern songs. The music. I mean, I know the music's not
true
to
the
period.
It's all original music. Yeah, and it's not true to period.
Right, but it's also not like Moulin Rouge, where they're borrowing liberally from the established canon of music. Pop culture.
Yeah. But it was interesting that they chose to do another P.T. Barnum / circus early turn of the century movie and not use it existing material, because I can think of two actual stage musicals with this whole subject. There's a musical called Barnum, which is the story of Barnum's circus, and then Sideshow, which is just about a bunch of sideshow freaks.
Interesting.
So it's just interesting that if Hugh Jackman wanted to push a P.T. Barnum musical or circus themed musical, he didn't just adapt one of those two existing pieces.
Well, a lot of times that's a thing where you may not get the rights. And if the project was one of these where they're like, oh, we really want these hot new songwriters to do something, and that way we can market it that way. I mean, even if you had the rights, you don't have to, you know, stick with that. So.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. I didn't realize those two musicals existed.
They're older. Sideshow did just have a revival 2 years ago, I think. But yeah, Sideshow is the one I know better than Barnum. I just know it exists. I don't really know the music.
And you would say at least Sideshow did a better job of sort of capturing that era than this movie?
It's definitely a lot grittier. It tells the story of two Siamese twin sisters.
Oh.
They're the focus.
And it's a little different.
Yeah. And doesn't have a happy Hollywood ending.
Well,
so,
I would say most of those stories probably did not in that era. So how many flames would you give this movie?
I would give it 3, just kind of in the middle. Hugh Jackman's good, decent, about the same as he was as in Les Mis.
Yeah.
I mean, he wasn't one of the bad parts of Les Mis, so.
Well, from what I remember, but no one's like Russell Crowe's singing voice in that movie.
So then we do have a third movie, which Brian saw.
I did. I saw Shape of Water. Or The Shape of Water.
So we just had two biopics. Is this a biopic?
I mean, it's a biopic if you think that Abe Sapien in Hellboy, a movie also directed by the director of this movie, Guillermo del Toro, you know, at least the second. He did the first and second one. Is a biopic, but otherwise, no. This was a very exciting Guillermo del Toro experience. And if you've ever seen any of his movies, Hellboy 1 and 2, Pan's Labyrinth, Crimson Horror, more recently, what's the one from Kronos? Kronos is one of the ones I need definitely to see. I have actually a couple holes in my Guillermo movie experience. One of my favorites that he's done is The Devil's Backbone, which is the first one I saw of his. Very, very understated compared to all of his other films, which tend to be very visually lush and rich. And just he's a beautiful storyteller, beautiful visionary director. And, you know, you may not connect with the movie he does. Like, there's certainly people who I know who've seen Pan's Labyrinth and thought the whole thing was awful and left the theater cursing the day that it was created. And those of us who were with him that liked the movie, in fact, liked it a lot, were kind of like, okay, well, thanks for that. But no, he's something to look at. He's definitely not what I would consider middle of the road, mediocre, boring. In fact, the choice of this movie, which is also a movie he wrote, kind of Tommy Wiseau-ish, at least in the sense that he wrote and directed this. It is about a love story, sort of untraditional love story, between a fish god and a mute sort of janitor, cleaning lady.
So she's just mute, right? She's not deaf?
She is just mute. In fact, one of the visual elements that's kind of interesting and you might think is a little heavy-handed is her... I think she was an orphan. Yes, her last name's Esposito. I did not know this. I guess people with the last name Esposito, it was at least common at some point for them to be orphans. Not heard that.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's an interesting, like, anyway. Not obviously, the name has gone on and a lot of people have it who aren't orphans. But she had, as a child, been attacked and, like, she had what looked like kind of claw marks or scratches on her throat that look kind of like gills in some way. So, you know, that's a smoking gun, or at least some kind of a visual metaphor for something. That actress that played her was really quite amazing. Sally Hawkins. I have heard of her several times and honestly don't think I've seen anything else she's done. But I really enjoyed her performance.
Was there any other big name actors in this? I know the guy who was the fish guy was Abe Sapien in Hellboy, right?
Doug Jones did play the fish god. I mean, they don't give him a name, the creature. Michael Shannon, who played Emperor Zod, General Zod in The Man of Steel, a very good actor.
Was he the bad guy in this?
Yes. A couple more. Let me just real quick just run through these. Richard Jenkins, who you've definitely seen. He's a very well-known actor, kind of character actor. But this is probably his best role. And if anyone I think from this movie deserves an Oscar besides the director, Del Toro, I would say Richard Jenkins deserves an Academy Award nomination at the very least for this role. He plays sort of a middle-aged to late middle-aged artist. Visual artist, painter, and the movie is set in like the 50s, late 50s, where sort of Mad Men-ish marketing is changing from the painted visual, like, you know, drawn ad to a photographic ad. And he's sort of a dinosaur in that industry. And he is very good friends with Sally Hawkins' character, Eliza. They, I think, are in the same apartment building above a theater. The Orpheum, which was kind of cool. Anyway, and it's set in Baltimore, and so it's got a lovely, like, lush, dark, neon-lit palette. And that era is fascinating visually, and having, like, Richard Jenkins play this amazing character, who also is very, very, very heavily suggested as gay. Like, I mean, they don't really hide that. It's not called that, maybe, but it's pretty damn clear. So great role for him. And then
is that actually a plot point though in the movie?
Yes. Oh, okay. Yeah. And then Octavia Spencer also shows up. She was fabulous in Hidden Figures.
She make pie.
She did not make pie.
From The Help, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. And Michael Stuhlbarg, I can never say his name. Oh, Stuhlbarg. Michael Stahlbar is another key role. And he plays this sort of scientist character who you basically figure out has a healthy interest in this fish character, who is captured by Michael Shannon's character and kept in this research facility where the janitor crew sort of find him and kind of take an interest in him, and where Eliza and him meet and then fall in love, and then she helps him escape and all this stuff. So I mean, that's the plot. It's Glenn Weldon on Pop Culture Happier, like, kind of did this little review where, I mean, he liked it, but then kept kind of going, well, this doesn't make sense. It's a fable. So there you go. It's a fable. The whole movie predicates on the fact that it is sort of a fable. It is sort of a classic sort of archetypal love story. You know it's going to happen. It's going to happen. Maybe not the way you thought it, but still broad strokes are going to happen. And if there are any inconsistencies or things that don't make sense or maybe ridiculous caricatures of, like, Michael Shannon, it'll all be okay.
He's never been a ridiculous character.
Yeah. Well, I will say that he is it's a good – he's, like, a great actor. Like, I like his stuff. He was just in At Home with Amy Sedaris playing not quite the same role, but very stern and sort of serious and sort of scary sort of person. So, I mean, like, he does that well, you know. But long story short, this movie's brilliant. Music by Desplat. I think it's Andre Desplat. Dennis Desplat. Not Del Toro's normal composer. He usually uses, I think it's Beltrami. Marco Beltrami. But anyway, for whatever reason, and maybe he's done this even more recently. I think it's Andre Desplat. Beautiful score. Looks like some whistling in there, some nice, like, French sort of accordion sound, French Italian. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a lot of, like, really nice musical ideas that sort of make the fable tone really set in. And it's just a beautiful movie. It really is something I'm glad I saw in the theater. It's weird because it was a limited release, but they're going wide. So I was kind of surprised it was in our local art house. It was at the Enzian. Mm-hmm. But I was like, all right, well, cool. I can see it here. I haven't been to the Enzian forever. But then, like, it opened wide, like, the next week. And it's not like – it's got big studio support. It's got big-name actors, big-name director. The thing that I think most people will probably be a little hung up on, even though it is fable, is there is a love story between a man – a fish man or a fish person and a woman. And the movie does not shy away from that. The movie makes it very clear early on that Eliza is sexual and that the fish person also is sexual. And it's for some people, it will probably be the thing. They're like, no, I can't do this. But
they're making a mermaid.
Exactly. But it's not gratuitous. They don't get crude with it. There's some very brutal scenes, too. Where the fish person sort of lashes out, you know, sort of like a primal instinct thing, which is also kind of horrifying. I'm trying not to spoil one thing, which kind of traumatized me a little bit. But you know, overall, just brilliant film, gorgeous. If you like that kind of thing, I think the closest I've compared this to, if you saw Jeunet's City of Lost Children, or actually any of his early stuff, it's got that same sensibility to it. Very dark kind of palette, muted color, some neon because of the era, but also sort of heightened reality. Mm-hmm. And City of Lost Children is one of my favorite films, so I was very happy that this movie kind of captured that vibe. Also set in like a very like ship, seaport kind of area, which this movie is in Baltimore. Even if it's mythical Baltimore, it does involve the sea a bit. So, yeah, I loved it. It was great. I'm sure I'm missing out on a lot of cool little things. But overall, I would give this at least a 4. I'm not consistent with my past ratings.
Right.
I think I gave Last Jedi a 4, like a solid 4. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I got to give the movie like a 4.5, but maybe a 4.25. Like, it's definitely not like the perfect movie, which to me is a 5.
Right.
It's better than a 4 for sure. So yeah, I would, especially if you're a fan of his movies. This movie is also, a lot of his movies are Spanish language or has subtitles mm-hmm. on. This movie is as American as it gets. I think there's some Russian subtitles because there's a Russian spy sub storyline. But no, overall, you know, easy to watch. You know, if you're a little squeamish, there might be some difficult moments. If you don't like the fish dick, I don't know. Yeah, I like that. I do kind of wonder, and I'd love to hear an interview with him about this, because he worked on some Lovecraft sort of stuff, some projects that never got made. And I wonder if there's some Lovecraft influence in here somewhere, in a good way, not in like the creepy, racist, awful way of some of the Lovecraft Cthulhu stuff. But like the fish people, fish god, I mean, the murky 50s era, black or not black and white, but that whole thing, that's all very like, I feel like Lovecraft. So even though Lovecraft was before that, I don't know. It'd be interesting to find out that like there was some subtle influence there. Or if, like we thought, this is Abe Sapien's love story origin, secret origin. Anyway, so that's the movies we have seen, and that's our kind of thoughts on it. Eric, you're going to see Shape of Water at some point.
I will. And hopefully I'll see The Room and then subsequently The Disaster Artist.
So if you did not enjoy these films as much as we did, or if you have even stronger enjoyment and you want to share those opinions with us, you can certainly do that at flameonshow.com. There are all our social media links at the bottom. And our biggest, most active community seems to be on Facebook, which is Flame On Show on Facebook. But if you want to tweet at us, Flame On Podcast is our Twitter, and other social media comments and things. Certainly on SoundCloud, if you want to leave a comment or post a review. The reviews are what we really love seeing. I don't know how much free time you have. Most people don't. So if you give us a few stars, or if you give us a nice little review on a service like iTunes or Google Play or wherever, or SoundCloud, you know, we really do appreciate that. It helps a lot. And of course, if you just tell a friend about our show, that always gets us quite a lot of goodwill and fellowship. The other big thing is, of course, we are funded by the listeners. We don't do an NPR model, but we do have a Patreon through Nerdy Show, patreon.com/nerdyshow. And there is a decent money cost to running this show and running the network. And so any dollars you donate to that as a monthly patron go a long way. If you give us either, if you're a patron already and you give us a shout out, or you are a new Patreon subscriber because of us, just let Nerdy Show know. And we are doing a thing where in the very near future, we'll start giving out drag names to all of our favorite listeners who are patrons. And you will get a drag name, and you will get a first song to perform. Now, you don't have to do this. I hope somebody does, because that would make my day. But if you don't, like some of our listeners who've already been like, I don't want that, that's cool. You don't have to get it, but we're going to do it anyway for those of you who do join. And you can do whatever you want with it at that point. But yeah, that's all we have this week. We'll be back in the very near future, about 2 weeks from now, with another exciting episode. We got some exciting things coming revolving around Drag Race that will be very exciting. And our full cast will be back very soon with even more pop culture fabulousness. So that's all I think we have. And keep on listening.
Yep. Bye, everybody.